This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's find out more about a very interesting story. We've heard stories from NPR about the cost of health care, and particular lately from the Indiana Public Broadcasting Station's crew about concern about health care costs. In fact, recently a group has gotten together to protest outside the Indianapolis office of Senator Young to talk about the push to get health care costs and drug expenses down in particular. And Giles Bruce from The Times has put out an article called Cost of Living, How to Afford Insulin, and of course dealing with diabetes care here in Northwest Indiana. And Giles, thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us first about the research that you got to do in getting things together for this article.
Yeah, well, this article is part of a series that we started. It's actually the first article in a series called Cost of Living, where we're looking at various medications and treatments, medical treatments that people often have trouble affording, and then looking at what resources are available in Northwest Indiana, what kind of discount programs and the like that people can access. So we started with insulin and diabetes care in general because insulin is one of the more expensive drugs out there, and one that has gone up astronomically in price over the last few years. I included some research on the cost and the price and what's some of the reasons for that increase are, and talked to some diabetes patients who have run into obstacles trying to get their medication and treatment, and then talk to some local hospitals, health centers who try to assist lower income people with affording these things.
One person in particular that you talked to that's highlighted in the story is Jeremy Kursak. He's from DeMott, and he has been basically born with type 1 diabetes. That's the type that stays with you for as long as you live. It's not like type 2, which you develop sometimes as you get older, but it's mentioned about his particular problems in trying to get hold of insulin. It's not very good, especially because he's out of work and he's trying to deal with other costs in addition to staying alive with his diabetes medication.
Yeah, he lost his job last October and his insurance along with it, and had been able to afford his insulin until that point, but without insurance, it was about $300 a month for his insulin. So, luckily he was able to get some money from his mom to help pay for that, and has since been declared as being disabled, so now he gets his insurance through Medicaid, which is the government program for poor and disabled people, and so he's able to afford it now, but it was tough for him for a while, and he was just surprised how much how much it had gone up in over the years.
I know you had a chance to talk with some of the healthcare providers here in the region for your story with HealthLink, which is the community health center network, seems to be set up here in the region. What do they say about how they're able to help their patients deal with the cost of insulin and other expenses that they have because of their diabetes?
Yeah, there are a lot of different programs out there, thankfully. One that community health centers like HealthLink use is called the 340B program. It's a federal program that gives discounted medications to clinics and hospitals that serve low-income people. So they're able to help most of their patients get cheaper medications through that. Otherwise, there are programs directly through the drug companies in many cases, where they'll give you free medications or discount medications. Beyond that, there's apps, websites, discount cards through programs like GoodRx, RX Assist, FamilyWise. There's a whole list of them in my article. A lot of these places also try to work on prevention and helping with symptoms, helping with people on diabetes, how to work out their diets and exercise routines and things like that. To try to keep them healthy, and those programs are generally free.
And I know you mentioned in particular one fellow from Valparaiso who has, unfortunately, his situation with his diabetes is a matter, I guess, that he has to try and work out himself as far as his own cost because of, I guess, kind of falling through the cracks, as it were. Joshua Sharon has a very interesting situation. Tell us what he was running into in trying to get his insurance company to cover his diabetes medication.
Yeah, well, Joshua, he was on, he preferred a specific type of diabetes medication that was a brand name, a little more costly, and his insurer declined to pay for it. You know, it wasn't on their list of medications they would cover. You know, and they wouldn't, you know, also wouldn't pay for some of his supplies. So his out-of-pocket costs are, had been about $400 a month. But then his pharmacy, you know, told him about one of these discount programs through the pharmaceutical company. So he is now, for the time being, I guess for the next 4 months at least, that's when, you know, where he may have to renew or try again. But, you know, he's now getting that medication free, at least for a few months.
Now, you mentioned that this is a series of articles that is coming out in print as well as in online in the Times. What are some of the other topics that you're going to be able to take up in the next parts of the series?
Yeah, well, we would, you know, we'd like to look into some other, you know, areas that you know, people have trouble accessing or particularly costly medications. You know, EpiPens could be one. And there's, you know, mental health treatments, treatment for opioid addiction, things like that. So we'll have, you know, with the healthcare system the way it is, with it being so costly, there are going to be plenty of things to write about.
Oh, so certainly so.
Yeah.
Well, looking forward to those stories when they come out here. Thanks very much, Giles, for this particular article dealing with the extreme cost for many people of getting covered for their diabetes and the other medications coming up, too. Thanks for spending some time with us today to talk about this topic.
Okay. Talk to you later, Chris.
We'll talk to you later. Giles Bruce is a reporter for The Times, and he covers healthcare and other related issues. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. An Indiana state senator who has served 14 years has decided to run for Indiana Attorney General. State Senator Karen Talion talked with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about why she's running and what she'd like to do if she's elected as the Attorney General.
Yeah, and it was tough because, you know, I've enjoyed my work in the Senate, but I've been asked by several people, and I was thinking about it. But then, you know, I think one of the things that really pushed me over the edge was Curtis Hill's decision to file the lawsuit to get or to overturn health care. And it would, you know, doing that would put thousands of people either without health care or without care for pre-existing conditions. And I don't think that's right. So I think this AG should be the advocate for people, for consumer protection, and not trying to take away health care. So that was one of the biggest things that pushed me.
Were there other things that he did that you disagreed with?
Well, I've disagreed with him since he walked in the door. I disagreed with his trying to push marriage between one man, one woman into the Republican platform. I've disagreed with his position on marijuana. I've disagreed with most things that he's done. So this was just one more.
And what are your positions on those things?
Well, I think that the first thing that I would do if I got into the office would be to remove Indiana from that lawsuit. You know, this would jeopardize our HIP 2.0 program, which was a Republican program, by the way, and that just has to stop. The other things, I think, you know, we have a problem with payroll fraud and employee misclassification here. You know, some people just think that this is a labor issue, but this is really a business issue. We have a lot of legitimate businesses, contractors and others who are, you know, doing business the right way and playing by the rules. And when you get some people who don't play by the rules, who pay their employees cash under the table or who classify people as 1099s when they really should be doing withholding. You know, it's bad for the businesses that play by the rules. So we've been trying to work on this for years at the State House, and we haven't gotten very far. So as AG, I believe it's one of the things that I would want to do is to set up a unit for fraud investigation.
So what else do you plan to do once you're in there, if you should be elected?
Here's the thing, you know, let me tell you about the latest on the marijuana. We twice have passed laws in the legislature to do something with CBD oil, and both times we've messed it up, or two out of three times we've messed it up, and we've got a problem right now with the legislation that we just passed this year. And I think that an active attorney general who's willing to say to the legislature, look, what you're doing is wrong, or it's illegal, or it's unconstitutional, you know, telling them that up front with a voice of authority is a role that the AG's office could have.
Do you think it'd be like a power issue, though, because since, you know, the House and the Senate are both Republican and you're Democrat and you know, they're comfortable and used to having that majority, do you think that they would try to find a way to, you know, oust you somehow?
Well, somebody's actually asked me, they said, Talion, you know, if you're elected AG, the next thing you know, they'll make it an appointed position. I certainly hope not. I would certainly think that that's a dangerous thing to do for either party because it can come around and bite you. And so...
How could it? How could it come around and bite?
Well, I mean, if the Republicans say, oh, we want it to be appointed, and then you get a Democrat governor, it would be hurting them. And the same thing with the Democrats. If the Democrats said, hey, we want to appoint this a position by the governor, and then you get a Republican governor, it just consolidates power. No, I think that the AG's office has the opportunity to be a balance between the governor, the legislature. You know, if the AG's office comes out with an opinion and says, listen, what you're doing, you know, this bill as it's written is illegal, and they pass it anyway and sign it anyway, they're on notice when the next person comes and sues them over, you know, over that legislation.
Has that happened before? Has the state of Indiana ever been sued for legislation that they've passed?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've spent millions of dollars defending lawsuits against legislation that everybody knew was bad. I've had conversations with legislators about certain bills, and you know, I said, you know what you're doing is against the law. Oh, yeah, we know. We're trying to change the law. We're trying to challenge a court decision. You know, and they know that, and they do it anyway. But if you had an attorney general in the office saying, ding, you can't do that.
So let me ask you this real quick. Does your decision to run for AG have anything to do with the accusations that were against AG Hill for the accusations of groping?
Let me be careful when I answer this. I think it means what he's doing in the office is the reason that I'm running. And the fact that we need balance in the State House is the reason that I'm running. The fact that he has gotten himself into a mess of trouble means that he's more vulnerable, but, you know, and it might make a run easier, but that's not the reason that I'm running.
Is there anything else that you want to add that maybe I haven't asked you about?
Well, let me just say this. You know, I don't even know if Curtis Hill is going to be my opponent. He has a disciplinary action in October, I think October, and he still has to get the nomination. You know, this is not a primary. This is a convention nomination. He still has to gain his party's nomination at their convention next summer. So I don't know if I'm going to be running against Curtis Hill, but I am running on my own record, what I have always, you know, done for the last 14 years in the State House, and what I think ought to be done in the Attorney General's office.
So this is a convention nomination. So when does that happen? When will you know whether or not you got the nomination? And then it goes to the general?
The convention nomination will be at our conventions. The Democrat convention is June of 2020. It might be the 15th. I'm not sure of the date. And then the Republicans, I'm not sure. They usually hold theirs right after the Democrats. So, yeah, it'll be June of next year.
So why is it not a primary? Why doesn't it not go to the primary election?
I don't know, Sharon. There were two offices that were convention slates. One of them is attorney general. Well, actually, so is the lieutenant governor's position officially. So lieutenant governor, the attorney general, and used to be the superintendent of public instruction.
Is this just an Indiana thing, or is this everywhere?
No, as far as I know, it's an Indiana thing. Every state will do it differently.
Thank you so much. Any other dates that we can look forward to? How are you going to campaign? Do you have any insights that you want to tell us on what you're going to do and how you're going to win this thing? I mean, I know you ran for governor before, but then didn't you? You kind of backed out of that, right?
I did that, yeah, relatively early. It was pretty clear that you know, most of the support was going to go to John Gregg. And, you know, I was not going to be the reason that the Democrat Party had a gubernatorial primary. So we worked out our differences. But I don't know that anybody, I mean, you have to be an attorney to run for this office. So that automatically kind of limits the field. And then, you know, maybe somebody else will step forward. But right now, I've got a lot of support from, you know, from a lot of different groups.
That's State Senator Karen Talion of Ogden Dunes, a Democrat who's talking with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about her upcoming campaign for Indiana Attorney General that will happen in 2020. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The beachfront city of Portage is reeling from a chemical spill. A steel plant dumped excess cyanide and ammonia into the river that leads into Lake Michigan. Thousands of fish died, and Portage's summer recreation industry is hurting from a ban on fishing and on swimming. The spill was bad enough, but area residents are angry that it took so long to learn about it. And reporter Michael Puente has more from Portage.
On most summer days, you can find Dana Bourne on his boat he calls Just Chillin'. He keeps the boat at the marina in Portage and often takes it into Lake Michigan to fish or swim, but not this past week.
Can't fish, obviously, because they're all dead. And then mostly we go out to the beach and swim, which I can't do right now either. So we used to be able to take the corner around here and just swim and come right back in, no big deal. Now I got to get all the way down to Michigan City almost before it's safe.
Bourne wonders why it took so long for the public to be notified.
They didn't really report to us about, you know, what happened until way later, which was kind of disgusting. You know, there was people in the beach up in, you know, in those days that they were still swimming in those chemicals, and no one even said anything about it.
Here's the timeline of what happened. On August 11th, the ArcelorMittal steel plant began spilling more ammonium and cyanide than its permit allows. On August 12th, a citizen found a dead fish in a river that ultimately leads to the lake. The person called the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and another state agency. But those agencies didn't notify the public. 2 days later, thousands more dead fish were found. Finally, 3 days after the steel plant knew of the toxic leak, word got to the city of Portage.
The facts are we should have been informed as soon as that spill occurred Sunday night, Monday. And we were not.
This is Portage Mayor John Cannon.
We were not informed by ArcelorMittal, and we were not informed by IDEM or DNR. No one contacted our office.
The steel plant is not supposed to spill excess toxic waste into the river that leads to Lake Michigan, but when it does...
Under their permit, they have a 24-hour window to report to the Indiana Department of Environmental Management when they find themselves non-compliant. That's a pretty big window.
Natalie Johnson directs Save the Dunes Council, a nonprofit environmental group. She wants to know why regulators kept the public in the dark.
An organization that is meant to safeguard the public's health and the health of the environment, we would want to see being more proactive and really alerting everyone that something isn't right. We didn't see that happen.
Communication about toxic spills along the lakefront are not always this low. Portage Mayor John Cannon says U.S. Steel Company immediately contacted his office this week when an oily substance was found in a local waterway.
But that's how it's supposed to work. That's the protocol that has happened since the chromium spills from U.S. Steel.
He's talking about a chromium spill in 2017. U.S. Steel ultimately made a legal agreement with Portage to communicate better. Mayor Cannon says ArcelorMittal could face fines for notifying the public so late, and that's on top of any fines for the spills. Neither ArcelorMittal or Item would provide comment on the time it took to notify the public about last week's toxic discharges. For affected boaters like Dana Bourne, a fine paid out by ArcelorMittal will mean little.
I feel like the steel mills have more money. They don't care so much. I mean, they're willing to pay the fine because it's way cheaper to pay the fine than actually just do what's supposed to be done. You got a lot of billionaires just throwing money out like it's nothing.
I'm Michael Puente.
Byline is a podcast of the Times of Northwest Indiana. And on this edition, reporter Cale Wilk and Olivia Hirsink will take a look at Larry Eiler, also known as the Interstate Killer, that devastated families in Indiana and Illinois during the 1980s. Newton County Councilman-at-Large Scott McCord and author Geraldine Kalarick join him to talk about the case and how Larry Eiler eluded authorities for nearly a decade.
This is Scott McCord, a councilman at large in Newton County. Olivia Hirsink, the Times of Northwest Indiana's morning breaking news reporter, and I took an excursion to Morocco to hear from him. McCord was the county's former coroner, and even a deputy coroner before that. Due to term limits, he clearly has a different occupation in the meantime, but he hopes to return to his old position in 2020. There's a particular memory that sticks with him when he began his work there.
When they gave me an office, one day I went up there and looked, and there were bags and boxes, cardboard boxes, of just records upon records upon records, because every coroner just kind of handed everything down to the next. Inside, I picked up one of the boxes and kind of shook it. I'm like, oh, this doesn't sound right. And two banker's boxes were full of bones and a bag, a plastic bag. The two bankers' boxes were labeled, if I remember correctly, Victim 3 and Victim 4. And they were the bones from the four boys that were found here back in 1983 up in Lake Village that were Larry Eiler's workings.
Finding those bones would inspire Scott to go on a mission, one which still has unanswered questions.
I took the bones and I thought to myself, this isn't right. We're not going to just have banker's boxes with bones in them and leave them. So I made it my mission in life to get these kids home.
We'll come back to Scott later. For now, it's important you know who Olivia is.
My name is Olivia Hirsink, and I am the morning cops and breaking news reporter here at the Times.
Olivia arrived in the newsroom back in May. She's a Gem State expat, having graduated from the University of Idaho, and is staking out a life as a fresh journalist in the Midwest. Being a breaking news and morning cops reporter isn't an easy gig, but it's exactly what Olivia wanted.
So, my dad is a defense attorney, actually, and when I was growing up, my mom often would work really, really early mornings, or she would be working late nights because she was a registered nurse, and so she'd be working in the emergency room. And so, my dad, rather than going to kindergarten or daycare some days, I would get to go with him to the courtroom. And so I'd kind of see him. I'd be back with my coloring books, though, while he's, you know, defending murderers and whatnot. But I would just, it just fascinated me. And I think the whole point of journalism is wondering why. And that's so true for crime, too. And like a lot of what my dad does is, you know, it's, you're trying to answer why. And I just think crime, it's a lot harder to find that why, because it's not as always as easily explainable. And I think you can just make some really, really fascinating stories out of it.
As you may already know, this is the third story featured in the Times of Northwest Indiana's Crimes That Rocked the Region series. Olivia originally tried finding info on a different case. With ill luck on her first venture, she received the tip on the story of Larry Eiler from Scott McCord. Eiler was a serial killer, coined the Highway Killer, that claimed victims in Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, and Wisconsin. He killed 21 people. Some believe there's more out there that haven't been found. Four victims, to which he confessed to murdering, were found in Newton County, just south of the Kankakee River.
October 19th, 1983, four bodies were found in a shallow grave in a Newton County cornfield just beside a barn. And so they think that, you know, maybe some of the initial killing actually took place in that barn or something happened there, but they were buried outside of it.
Two of them were identified, John Bartlett and Michael Bauer. The other two still remain unidentified to this day.
And so three of them were white, one was African-American, and he was separated off to the side because in a confession, Hyler even admitted that he didn't think it was right putting together the mixed races. And so he separated them out.
But before Hyler was even associated with these victims, he wasn't even on the map. But one journalist pursued his path and story.
Oh, I didn't even know if I had this. Holy cow. Oh, these are good. These are all the pictures from the book. That's why they're all here. I just grabbed stuff for you guys.
So that's why it's chaotic.
I just threw stuff in a bin, and it was like, I had other crap in the bin, and it's like,
This is Geraldine Kolarik. She's a former TV journalist that spent portions of her career at CBS and then ABC in Chicago. She took some time to talk to Olivia and I about Larry Hyler. She still stays active in a freelance capacity, as evident by the several phone calls she'd get during our chat.
Alrighty, I'll get back to you. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye. I don't know why all of a sudden nothing happens for years and all of a sudden... Blah, 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 blah. I was with Channel 7 Eyewitness News. I was the assignment editor.
In that role, she would do beat checks, including with coroners.
Jared, we've been getting bodies turning up here in Indiana. And he says, you know, I really think it's a homosexual serial killer. I says, what do you mean? How? He says, we've had three different bodies here. And they're all unidentified. And they all have their pants partly pulled down. And it's a similar stab wounds, 30 stab wounds, like eviscerated. And he told me some other personal things that they found on the bodies. And he says, I think that they're all gay. And I says, that's strange. I says, God, I got a guy, a kid, this Scott, this kid that was found out in Kankakee. And it was the same pattern. And I says, my gosh, I says, you know what? Lake County, Illinois has two murders that they have, and it's the same thing. But this guy, one of the guys had his hand cut off.
As more victims and connections seemed to be turning up, she pitched the story.
And I said, we want to do this. It might be a homosexual serial killer. Well, the whole room was like, oh, no, 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 no. No, how do you know? How do you know? I says, well, because there are some homosexual overtones on this, the multiple stab wounds, and they think that it's a man killing other men. And they were like, well, do the police say this? Well, there's a task force. And they said, well, let's wait until we have a little more information. I says, no, it's definitely a serial killer. And they poo-pooed the story.
With no luck, she turned to an old friend with the Gay Life newspaper. The Newton County coroner at the time wanted to know if sketches of some of the victims could run with the story she was pitching.
So I brought my court artist, Andy Austin. I says, Andy, I'll pay you $100 to help him. So she sketched them of what they would look like alive. And they ran them in the Gay Life newspaper. And all of a sudden, in a week, they all were identified as male prostitutes from Chicago.
Geraldine pitched the story again. Those at the TV station still didn't want it. Then, one more Illinois victim came up, Ralph Calise.
This was the first time they found an ID card, because when Larry killed him and dragged his body across the field, his driver's license came out of his pocket. And so this was the first victim where they had an ID. And Ralph Calise was a young boy from Oak Park. And now they had a name. And everything.
Then Larry Hyler gets apprehended in Indiana.
They found footprints and they found tire tracks. Okay. Exactly 2 to 3 weeks later, after the task force meeting, they had a name. They had a name of Larry Eiler because he was into S&M. And somebody in Indianapolis got the name on a hotline. And they had the name of they knew his license plate. They knew the pickup truck he was in. A Lowell, Indiana state trooper was driving along in the morning. I forgot the date. I'm sorry about that. And he saw a man leaving a pickup truck with a young boy and going down a ditch at sunrise. So he ran the license plate and he saw that the guy was a suspect in a number of serial killings. So the police officer went down to the ditch where the two guys were, asked him to get out of the ditch, come over there. And he asked him, are you Larry Eiler? And he said, yes. And he said, he then read him his rights and handcuffed him and put him in the squad car, called for backups, and took the kid and towed the pickup truck in.
But they didn't go by the book.
Because when they handcuffed him and they didn't have any probable cause to arrest him, if they would have said to Larry, Larry, can you come down? We'd like to talk to you, and there's a task force that would like to speak to you. Larry probably would have said, okay. And there would have been no problem if they would have said, then we want to search your truck and everything. But the minute they handcuffed him, brought him in, they violated his constitutional rights. And Lake County, nobody knew that right at that time. But all this evidence led to when Larry was out there and he killed Ralph Calise, he stepped in his blood. Then he put his boots back on. Guess what's inside these boots? Ralph Calise's blood. Both boots, the blood was in there. They found the knife. The knife was positive, Ralph Calise's blood. The boots matched the boot print found on the scene. The tire tracks marked the tire tracks on the scene. Larry was now a suspect in 25 murders. Larry was brought in, and the evidence of the knife that you see and the boots and all that that was going to be used in the murder of Ralph Calise was suppressed. It could not be used against him. So they didn't bring anything. So when he walked free, the sheriff said, and I stood next to me, he said he's freed, freed to kill. It's a matter of time before he kills again. And then, Lord and behold, 3 months later, another body is found of another boy in Illinois. Again, my office says to me, just let it rest. Stop it. Just let it rest. You're done with the story. And of course, everything pointed to Larry Eiler. And then, all of a sudden, you have a young boy. You find the body of a young boy on August 21st, 1984. Named Danny Bridges, male prostitute, here in Chicago at 1628 Sherwin, is found cut up in four bags in a dumpster. And there's a picture here of the police going through the dumpster. And guess what? That's the case that Larry Eiler is. That's the body of Danny Bridges. In these garbage bags. He cut them up in his apartment.
Eiler would be formally charged with Daniel Bridges' murder. Though his trial wouldn't be for another 2 years, Eiler maintained his innocence. He admitted to dismembering and disposing of the body, but alleged Robert Little, a professor at Indiana State University, had been an accomplice. Although Little appeared in court, he ultimately was never convicted. Kolarik would go on to leave the station and would further pursue Larry Eiler's story for her book, Free to Kill.
But the importance of Free to Kill was not only did it reopen all these murders, it made police sensitive to the fact that men can become victims of serial killers. Back in the 1980s and 90s, if you were gay, oh God forbid, and if you were a gay man, oh, you were a sign of abuse. And the idea that men could become victims of a serial killer was highly unknown. If they were young women, oh my God, you never would have seen a guy free on 25 murders of young women, prostitutes, anything. But because they were men and possibly gay men, then that was taboo. But why? You're a journalist. Mm-hmm. And a true journalist doesn't stop because somebody says no. I mean, there's something in us for justice and wanting to tell the truth.
For Scott McCord, any new lead in his quest excites him. Victims 3 and 4 were white and black men, respectively. Scott gave them names, Brad and Adam. As he says, you can forget a number, but you can't forget a name. He has composite sketches for them. He sent their dental records and DNA to the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System and the Combined DNA Index System. Nothing. When Scott left office, he gave the two a funeral. They now reside in a local mausoleum. But he still tries to find something, anything, of their identities. It's hard as time goes along.
One day, maybe. Mm-hmm. And that's what I just keep saying. That's what I keep saying about these kids, one day. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, you know, these kids are my age now, or thereabouts, which means their parents are probably gone. Mm-hmm. So once the siblings start being gone, if they had siblings, if they had brothers and sisters, we're going to lose that DNA. We're going to lose that. I mean, you never really lose it. You can go down further through the line, but eventually people are just going to forget. You know, after mom and dad die, and, you know, they were looking for them, and now brothers and sisters are starting to die. After that, nobody cares anymore. Nobody remembers anymore. And that's going to be the sad part is... And it was really a sad day when we did the funeral, because I knew then that it was kind of a final, you know, this was the final hoorah for him.
Despite others having moved on, Scott hasn't. He has an inner spirit that pushes him above and beyond to complete what he signed up for.
As a coroner, you take an oath to use every means possible to identify a body. It's just one of those things that, you know, you think back on it and you think, if those were my kids, I'd want somebody looking for them. These are my kids. I have two children of my own. Those are my children. These are my kids. Mm-hmm. They've always been that. I've always referred to them as my kids. I always will until they go home. Until somebody else claims them.
And thanks to our friends Kale Wilk and Olivia Hirsink of The Times. And you can hear the full Byline podcast by going to nwitimes.com and click on the link for digital exclusives. This is Regionally Speaking. Bernard Carter has been the Lake County prosecuting attorney for, if the math is correct, 26 years now, and he wants to run again. In fact, he's decided, even though the election that he would campaign in and run again doesn't come up for a while, he's decided to take an early decision to get out there and make himself known to everyone that he wants another term of office. And we are lucky to have him in the studio with us to talk about it. Mr. Carter, thank you very much for being with us.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's ask the question, why did you decide in 2019 that you are going to run for office in 2022?
That's correct. You know, ordinarily, in a mid-year term, you either make some indication that you're going to run. So usually it's done about a year before the election actually takes place. Mm-hmm. In this particular occasion, one of the reasons I did it, as mentioned, I've been prosecutor for 26 years. I enjoy what I do. I'm very passionate in what I do. I'm an avid community speaker, avid activist in working in the community, trying to reduce crime. I find that that's my passion, as well as in the courtroom, as well as managing 200 people in my office. And one of the things that was brought to my attention, that there were people going around saying, you know, Bernie's not going to run again, and let's do some other plans. And I just wanted to make it perfectly clear that I have all intentions of running again. I certainly are doing everything I can to make Lake County a better place. I'm committed to that. And I didn't want that rumor in the back saying, oh, he's going to give it up. in light of the fact that I've been here 26 years, that would be something that people would digest. They say, well, you know, he's been there a long time, so maybe he is giving it up. And I wanted to indicate to him that I don't have that desire. The people in my office, I have some fantastic workers, bees in my office, as I call them. That's the support staff. That's the secretaries. That's the attorneys, the investigators in our office, caseworkers in our office. They are all professional people who aren't political. The only political person really in reality, and this has been kind of historical in terms of my term, the only political person per se in my office is me. Mm-hmm. I don't try to bring in political people to try to help me be political. I don't bring in political people to try to help me handle the politics of staying in office. What I do is hire people who are good people, people who have nothing to do with politics, who are come with a tool, come with desire, come with the education to be the best attorney, the best worker they possibly can be, and that's all I ask of them. And then in return, the citizens of Lake County get a good product, and they don't get a product that is being tarnished by overemphasis of politics inside the office. And I don't talk politics inside the office. I don't allow my employees to talk politics with me inside the office, and I like it that way. And in light of that, those rumors are saying, well, Bernie Carter's not running again. I had to quiet those rumors to say, I'm definitely running again. And I think I serve the people well, and I'm going to continue to do so.
What was the situation like 26 years ago? Now, you'd served as a judge before then.
That's correct.
And you'd serve, of course, as an attorney before judges.
That's correct.
And probably before prosecutors, too, on cases that you had. But what was the situation like 26 years ago? And I suppose the obvious answer would be a lot worse than it is today.
Yes.
But what was the situation as far as law enforcement and the state of crime, so to speak, in Lake County like when you came into office the first time?
Well, when I first came into office, as mentioned, I used to be a deputy prosecutor, and then I went on to be on the bench for 4 years, and then Evan Bayh appointed me prosecutor. I didn't run for prosecutor. Mm-hmm. I got appointed by the then governor, Evan Bayh, which at the time state statutes allowed the governor to make an appointment in case of a vacancy. John DiGiulio had left and went to the Jack Crawford had left and went to the Gaming Commission. John DiGiulio came in and took his position, and then as John was there, he got an offer to be a United States attorney for the Northern District. So he said, you know, that was a desire that he wanted, and he's now a federal judge in the Northern District, located in South Bend. So John wanted to be a U.S. attorney, wanted to be a federal judge, so he went in that direction. So when that position opened up, I got a call from Evan Bayh. I didn't solicit it. I got a call from Evan Bayh saying, Bernie, would you be interested in it? I think you should put your name in. Mm-hmm. So when the governor tells you to put your name in and he's the one making a selection, that's a kind of clear indication that I might have a good shot at it. So yes. I put my name in. But absent that call, I would have never put my name in. How the situation is today, one of the reasons I left the bench is because I thought I had a gift to give to the community. Not only my legal aspect of it, not only that I had done 3 death penalty cases by that time, I had done 56 murder cases, I've done a host of rapes, robberies, every type of case you can imagine. Before I became prosecutor, I had prosecuted all those cases, and I did real well. My statistics were good, my conviction rate was good, and I had a passion for the courtroom. But the main passion I had was trying to reach out to our youth, try to get our youth to understand that you don't have to go down that road. And you don't have to be in a violent situation. You may have grown up in a situation that festered that type of activity, but you don't have. You can say no to it. So I've been spending my whole career, the last 26 years, doing just that. And I think, you know, it's hard to measure it, but I certainly know it made a difference. I have so many young people come to me and say, you know, Mr. Carter, you spoke to me 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and now I'm a lawyer, a doctor, I'm working in the mill, I'm living good. And I was in the wrong direction at the time when you had that discussion with me, and what you said kind of resonated and is one of the contributing factors to where I'm at today. I've had so many. My wife told me the other day, she met this photographer, and he said that, you know, I talked to your husband 20 years ago, and he just kind of electrified me and motivated me to say, I'm not going to be like my dad. His father was in prison. His grandfather was in prison. He said, I'm not going to be a third generation in prison, and that kind of motivated him. So that helps motivate me, gives me a good indication that I think I'm on the right track. How you measure that, it's hard to measure it because we do have crime today. Our crime is down. Right now we have, unfortunately, 41 homicides in this county. When I took office, we were in excess of 100 for a year. So that has reduced drastically. And I'm not saying it was because of me. It's because of law enforcement. I think it's because of some of the things that is done by a lot of the activists and public service people have a lot to do with it. One of the things that I think is very clear is that society, this is not just Lake County, but society put too much emphasis on law enforcement. When I say law enforcement, I mean the police, the prosecutor, and the courts, and the prisons. They put too much emphasis on those four entities solving our problems. It ain't going to happen. It don't happen. Law enforcement is a reactionary event. Police come when there's a demand. Prosecutors prosecute when the case is there. Judges sentence based on what's there. Prisons house you because you've been sent there. All reactionary branches. So we have to have, as a society, as a government, and I think as a community, we have to have people being in a positive direction and trying to deter crime so it don't get to us. And there's methods and there's people out there doing that. And I think it's effective. So to answer your question, certainly the homicide rate, the violent crime rate has been reduced, but it's still too high.
We still have problems, unfortunately, with drugs. They've been with us forever, it seems. Are we dealing better with the, for example, the opioid crisis and with the meth crisis now than we have in the years past?
No, absolutely not. And I give you a couple of examples. I say very strongly, and people, you know, take issue with this sometimes, but I don't see the facts are there. The pharmaceutical companies and many of our doctors are bigger drug dealers than the drug dealers that are on the streets in our county. And I say that very, very seriously and very profound. And I, as mentioned, you and I were talking off record here. I was on the governor's task force.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the consensus that the task force came up with. And all professional people, medical people on that, professors, law enforcement, the state superintendent of police, all of us were on that committee. A real nice group of people and a balance of people. And one of our findings was that the pharmaceutical companies put pressure on doctors to prescribe many of these drugs that patients later, and we have thousands of cases and examples of that, where people later were addicted to. And once they was prescribed 2 or 3 weeks and they became addicted to it, and then they jump around finding doctor after doctor to give them medication. And then when the doctors finally say, enough is enough, you don't have the problem, you got an addiction problem, you don't have a medical problem, you don't have pain. Then they go up to the streets and buy the drugs. So the pharmaceutical companies as well as the doctors, and they've been sued, and a lot of them have been sued. The pharmaceutical companies are as responsible as many of the drug cartel. And that's the sad part. So that's a new ingredient to our addiction problem. We've always had an addiction problem in this country. I don't know how far you go back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s.
Oh, yes, that's right. We know this.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you've seen it more now if you look back in terms of the entertainment field. Mm-hmm. Many of our great artists and great jazz players and were addicted to drugs, and they had that underground heroin market. Well, they were addicted to it, but certainly the lay persons were also out there doing the same thing too.
One of the other issues I know that you're very, very strong on and have done your best to push for is to try to resolve, and at least try to, maybe better to say, prioritize the sex crimes that have happened, domestic violence cases that have happened here in Lake County. And you've asked for some help, and the county council is doing their best to help you, trying to seek some federal funds. Tell us what the latest is there.
Absolutely. We've applied for a number of different grants from the federal government to assist us in bringing qualified attorneys as well as support staff. Our VOCAL grant, which is a federal grant, helps us employ young people who are interested in that field, specializing in that field. And they come in our office and they concentrate in that direction. That's their main concern. So they're not doing a lot of other different things. So the county council has been very great with saying whatever we need to do to help you get this funding, we will do. At the same time, when we organize the special victim unit, we're specializing in certain types of crime. So I don't have a deputy who's doing white-collar crime and doing robberies and things of that nature, dealing with young children who've been molested, or a young lady who has been molested, or a young man who has been molested, yet they're talking to an attorney that don't specialize in that, don't have the sensitivity, and don't have the tools necessary to make that person feel comfortable, as well as presenting that case in front of a jury. Now we have four attorneys that we have in our office that do nothing but sex crimes, and they're excellent, and they really present themselves well in front of a jury. They present themselves well in front of a victim who they're talking to, and how to handle that victim, how to handle that victim's family, and how to get people motivated to want to prosecute these cases. Because many times cases are dismissed because lack of cooperation.
We only have about a minute left here. Mm-hmm. Prosecutor Carter, what are you looking ahead in the next year, probably before the official campaign gets underway, that you would like to get done?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I'm working with this organization, Indiana Parenting Institute. You can go up online and look at them. They're an excellent organization, and what they're doing is the key to, I think, resolving crime. And I mentioned about law enforcement, not to answer necessarily. The Indiana Parenting Institute, their whole method is to work with parents, to get parents to be better parents, to get parents to understand that they are a key ingredient. They're the first law enforcement of that child's life, and they can keep that child out of trouble. They can help that child have the tools necessary to avoid certain things, that pitfalls that other children can't. And another thing I'm real strong on is children having children. We can't have that. That's a recipe to disaster. I'm real strong, and I'm not coming from a religious standpoint, but I'm real strong on, if you want a child, get married. If you have a child, if almost, you know, if possible, get married to that woman, get married to that man. Make that family unit so you be there in that child's life. So when you wake up in the morning, you're talking to that child, you're seeing that child go off to school, not a weekend father, or not a every 6 month you're there in that child, or you're sending a check in. So I'm real strong, and I kind of promote that as much as I possibly can. And I know it's not realistic to the extent that it's going to happen to everyone, but it does resonate. And there are people who say, you know, I'm going to do it the right way. I'm going to wait till I get my education, wait till I have some money in the bank, and wait till I find the right person, and that's when I'm going to make that serious step.
Well, it sounds like it's an ambitious campaign, to be sure, but it's one that at least you can certainly work toward, and maybe someday you can resolve, to be sure.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for spending time to talk with us about this, and we hope to have a chance. I know that you're a very, very busy person.
Yes.
At the County
Government
Center. I will
make time any day.
But I'm glad that you spent some time with us today, and we hope to have a chance to talk again here. Maybe we'll talk a little closer to when the official campaign gets underway, but it's certainly nice to have a chance to chat with you today about the issues that are important here in Lake County, dealing with crime and helping law enforcement all around. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's Lake County Prosecutor Bernard Carter on his visit to Lakeshore Public Radio and Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday. Good morning. That's for this week as well, too. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. And our thanks, of course, to the Times of Northwest Indiana's Giles Bruce and Cale Wilk for their contributions. To Michael Puente, a reporter who's provided the info about the latest from the community of Portage. And to Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson, and our conversation as well with Lake County Prosecutor Bernard Carter. We'll be back with you on Monday.